everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast, and welcome back to Star Trek. It's happening, folks. We are officially back on the Star Trek Season 3 train. Vinny Caravella, welcome back as always.
Yeah, great to be back. I'm so glad to get back into the prime Star Trek here. The reason for the season with some really delicious episodes. Thanks, Alex.
Yes, very delicious turkeys all around. Brad Shoemaker, we are able to return to Star Trek because you are back. Welcome back,
sir. It's true. Hello. Thank you for having me here in the stars.
It has been, your absence has been notable throughout this time. We have had some guests on the show who have filled in for you. You will have some movie catching up to do at some point down the road. I was thinking maybe for like a ramble cast, you could just give some thoughts on those movies we did while you were gone.
Sure.
But that's not what we're talking about today. Today, we are back into the stars, going where people went in the 60s and maybe have not gone back to since for reasons that will become apparent when we talk about these two episodes. The Paradise Syndrome and the Children Shall Lead, or I should say and the Children Shall Leave, because the and is in the title. These are two of the worst episodes of Star Trek I've ever seen.
I mean, that's saying something. I one of them is probably worse to me than the other.
I agree with that. And somehow it's not the one involving Native Americans, actually.
Okay.
Because that one's bad, but I think the kids one might be considerably worse.
I wasn't sure, genuinely, which one you meant when you said that.
They just don't do anything.
No. They do is bad.
I've said it many times. The worst sin that something can commit is to be boring.
Yeah.
And I felt I dozed off during both of these episodes.
They probably could be, first of all, maybe this might be a little harsh, but they probably could not exist. Second of all, they could probably be cut down to about 10 minutes for their plot.
Yeah.
Because both just have filler from the setup.
Endless wheel spinning.
Yeah. That is just nothing happens and it all just disappears and goes away.
Yeah.
Like literally at the end of Paradise Syndrome kind of disappears and goes away. And you're like,
a literal hand waving of the only meaningful consequence that comes from the episode.
Yeah. And both of these, you know what? I'm sure we're going to start with Paradise Syndrome, but the ends of both of these episodes are out of scope tragic for Star Trek. Like if you were to describe what happens at the ends of these episodes, they are absolutely tragic ends to both of these things in ways that I think Paradise Syndrome handles a little bit more with some gravitas than it does.
It tries at least.
Yeah. Then the Children Shall Lead. The Children Shall Lead is so bizarre at the end. It is so hand waved away that, it is
your parents
are
dead.
and like not only that, like you trick them, and this trickster god made you do all this stuff with crying children that are escorted out of a room, and Kirk being like, "Those damn kids."
Yep.
Like we dropped them off pretty soon.
I mean, they've dispensed with this mechanism from, was it both seasons prior to this, or maybe just season two, where like every episode ends with a chuckle on the bridge,
right?
You know, like you had to shove a joke in there, no matter how tonally dissonant it was. They're not doing that anymore, but I'm not sure it's for the better.
Well,
honestly, if this is how they're going to handle it.
And the really funny thing, and we'll talk about it more, but like the funny thing is they don't do the chuckle hand wave thing in "And the Children Shall Lead," but they do have DeForest Kelly, who has been absent through most of the episode, wander in and just be like, "Ah, the kids are crying. Good."
It's probably
now
good.
Now I can get to work.
Yeah. Both these episodes are tonally all over the place. They are truly strange constructions, even in the context of this era of Star Trek. And again, we know, for anyone who has forgotten, we know this season is like this because of budget considerations, creative people leaving. A variety of factors have conspired to make this season a little bit more of a nightmare, but I'm not sure this season is going to get much worse than these two. Like, I remember some other episodes from this season. I had never seen "And the Children Shall Lead" before. I think we might actually be scraping the bottom of this season right now.
Well, that's encouraging, then.
Except for the finale, which is also absolute dog shit. But I feel like there are better episodes to come than this.
It really just feels like the writing is beginning of the problems with both of these, you know, like not necessarily anything on the screen budget wise, although I think some of the editing is extremely ramshackle. In parts, especially in the first one here, but I guess both actually, but really it's just like there has been much better writing in this show prior to this.
And I really feel like the secondary characters are suffering the most through a lot of this. Like, you know, you're getting a lot of Kirk hamming it up. There's plenty of Spock doing Spock things. But like, so far in every episode we've watched, I feel like Chekhov, Uhura, Sulu, anytime they come up in the conversation, it's because something horrible is happening to them and they are useless.
Yeah.
They are being rendered useless.
Yeah, these two episodes don't really, they are mostly Kirk vehicles.
Like, Uhura's not even in Paradise Syndrome, I think, at all, except for, like, one shot on the bridge. That's it. Well, let's take these one by one, go through them, give them their due, such as it is, and we will start with the Paradise Syndrome, episode 3, in the order here. An episode that is written by someone who has written for Star Trek before in the form of Margaret Armin, who previously wrote the episode The Gamesters of Triskelion.
Okay. Okay.
Another fairly bad episode of this show.
Was that the brains that bet on the arena combat?
Yes. Okay. And the thralls and all of that. She goes on to write one more this season. I have no idea if that one is any good or not, but based on her previous work, I'm going to guess no. Our director here is Judd Taylor, who is, I think, our most prolific director through this season. He does like 5 episodes of this season. He has never been on the show before. This is a guy who just directs a lot of episodes of television and a lot of TV movies for basically his entire career. And the original name for this episode, The Pale Face.
Oh, good.
Wow.
Just to really hammer this whole thing home.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, hey. Questionable portrayal of an existing Earth culture.
Yes.
Kind of a hallmark of Gene Roddenberry era Star Trek.
Especially native populations.
Right. Like, that certainly continues into Next Generation for a ways while he's still alive.
And the thing is, I don't get the sense there was ever even any real talk about the idea of, hey, maybe we should do a different alien species or, you know, not just have it be natives. No, I think this is how this episode was written, so it's not a pure instance of them just saying we're saving budget by going into the Western closet for the costumes, like they designed it this way. And this is actually the only episode in the season that has extensive location filming in it. They are filming most of this at the Franklin Reservoir around Los Angeles, a heavily filmed location that is best known as the fishing hole from the opening of the Andy Griffith Show.
Okay.
And also, I will say, the outdoor stuff in this, while it is a nice location, it is very funny. There are at least 2 or 3 shots in this where you can tell they didn't have time to do more takes because there are just flies everywhere.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Everywhere.
I mean, it seems annoying. I mean, a lot of this is inside inside very small sets also, right? Like, it's inside the hut.
Yes,
it is inside
all that
the
stuff is probably done on a soundstage.
Yeah.
But, like, the outdoor stuff is just by this lake reservoir area.
When they're a lot of their very silly playing tag.
Uh-huh.
Whatever.
Like, there's a very prominent close-up of Kirk with a fly walking across his face.
Yes.
At one point, I was just like, you don't have another take you could have used? I guess it's TV.
It's TV, I mean, and they don't have a lot of time or budget right now. As I said, this is the last time we will be getting an extensive outdoor location. I think there's a fight scene in a later episode that is also shot outdoors, but that's basically it. And this is an episode, as you can probably imagine, for the time period. The majority of these actors playing natives are not natives. The ones that are do not have speaking parts. Every native character in this that says a line is a white actor. In grease paint, more or less. The one exception to the grease paint rule, I believe, is Richard Hale as Goro, the sort of chief of the natives. He's just a guy with a slightly darker complexion who is, I believe, from Tennessee. So he is, and he's an actor of some note. He was in a lot of movies, not in huge parts, but he had small roles in stuff like To Kill a Mockingbird, Julius Caesar, Angels in the Outfield, Ben-Hur, variety of other things, but mostly he played Middle Eastern and native characters, especially in Westerns. That was his bread and butter.
And again, not of native descent himself.
No, not that I can tell.
He's got a good chiseled face, though. I can see why he was in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think if he had just been playing, let's just say, you know, parts that were more within the line of his genealogy, it might have been less problematic because he's a decent enough actor. Less good is Rudy Solari as Salish, the sort of hunky medicine man who is mad when Kirk shows up. This guy is Italian. He's just Italian. He's definitely not native and was mostly a guy who did some TV guest work, but was never really that big. In fact, I think this role might actually be the most notable thing he was ever in, though he did do some episodes of Mission Impossible and Gunsmoke and Charlie's Angels and somehow no Mannix. Somehow.
Somehow.
But like a lot of other guest actors on this, he went on to become a fairly well-regarded acting coach. And then there is Sabrina Scharf as Mira Mani, the comely native lass who Kirk falls in love with, who is profoundly white. So this woman's story is really wild. At the age of 15, she apparently eloped with her algebra teacher.
Oh.
And then had the marriage annulled a few years later. And then went on to become a Playboy bunny almost immediately after that in 1962. Then she decided she was into acting and became an actress. And then, so she got cast in an episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. that this director, Judd Taylor, happened to cast her in. So I assume that's how she got this part, is Judd Taylor's like, you need a pretty lady? I got a pretty lady for you. Here you go. And she did have one big movie role. She was in the movie Easy Rider, and like it was a not nothing role in that. But after that, it was basically television work, and then she just stopped acting in 1975 and did run a losing campaign to become California's first female state senator in the 80s, I believe.
Oh, hell yeah.
Did not win, but, you know, someone else eventually became the first female state senator there, just not her.
Was it Dianne Feinstein?
She's a senator. I don't think she was ever a state senator. She was a mayor, and then I think she became a senator. Yeah, state senator.
Oh, sorry. She's not terrible in this. She just has nothing to do.
Well, the character isn't anything. Like, she's just a lady who likes Kirk. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And a collection of some native tropes that are maybe not great. That's about it. Yeah,
right.
But the real thing here is, like, this is yet another example of them going down to a planet and just running into humans. Like, there's just people from an ancient Earth culture here.
Well, but it's weirdly inconsistent with last season, though, because they express several times surprise at, like, you know, how are these pine trees here?
Yeah, why does this planet look like Earth?
Look at those pine trees and that lake. I swear that's honeysuckle I smell.
I swear that's a little orange blossom thrown in. It's unbelievable. Growth. Exactly like that of Earth. On a planet half a galaxy away. What are the odds on such duplication?
Astronomical, Captain. The relative size, age, and composition of this planet makes it highly improbable that it would evolve similarly to Earth in any way.
Like, I think they quite literally say, like, what are the odds that all of this life would evolve just like it was on Earth? One season after they encountered an alien culture that not only was, like, perfectly human, but had evolved the exact same political system and identity as the United States of America.
Yep.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
There's the mafia,
there was the gangster
one, and
planet,
the Nazis.
There was the Nazi planet.
It's like, y'all have been observing this kind of thing regularly for a while. Why are you so surprised?
This is why I think this episode has to be one of the most important Star Trek episodes, because in this episode we learn, or it is hypothesized, that precursor culture has been stealing people from Earth, endangered cultures, and seeding them throughout the galaxy and putting up meteor or asteroid deflector shields. But also, now we know why. We've explained the entire Star Trek galaxy, because somebody's been scooping up folks and then sticking them on other planets where they then stay in stasis forever
and just never evolve at all.
Yeah, never evolve.
Not the last time that Star Trek will go out of its way to explain why all of the aliens are humanoid.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I love them trying their best to do it.
I think TNG's thing that it lands on is a much more thoughtful, if not necessarily believable, explanation for this, which never comes up again.
Oh, okay.
This thing of the protectors thing never comes up again, as far as I know.
It's such a massive thing to discover and then just toss off at the end of this, like it doesn't matter.
Like, it legitimately feels like at some point, in some creative meeting, Gene Roddenberry just groused about the fact that it was like, you know what? we have been using human cultures a lot. We have to figure out how to explain that, and then that's it. It's just that throwaway line is thrown in there.
No time really spent on why, say, maybe some of these cultures may have become endangered or
No. We're not talking about any of that.
No, that's outside the scope. But
why would the Navajo have had any problems on Earth, honestly?
Just mush them all together. Let's disregard any of the cultural differences between any of the tribes. Mush them all together, stick them on this planet, and look how peaceful it is. Ah, Tahiti syndrome.
It's paradise planet. You know, that thing we all know, Tahiti syndrome.
That we've definitely talked about before on any of the other 15 paradise planets we've been on.
What's the matter, Jim?
What? Oh, nothing. Just so peaceful. Uncomplicated. No problems. No command decisions. Just living.
Typical human reaction. An idyllic natural setting. Back in the 20th century, we referred to it as the Tahiti syndrome. It's particularly common to overpressured leader types like starship captains.
Tahiti syndrome.
You know, the thing that's interesting to me is that, like, you could also just do this episode and not remark on the fact that the planet looks like Earth at all, because they do that all the fucking time. They're just like, hey, there's trees here, there's grass here. You just put a fucking weird bush in there, and it's like, it's an alien planet.
Totally. Like, everybody here could be bright blue and still Kirk could have been like, ah, it's a paradise.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think this story benefits in the slightest from this being in like a recognizably indigenous Earth culture, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's something like later Star Trek got much better at creating alien equivalents of very obvious human concepts where it's like there's no mystery about what it is they're referencing, but it's still like distinct enough to be believable.
I mean, it could be a thing that at the time, maybe the sentiment was like, oh, the native peoples of America live such a more in touch with the environment, peaceful lives. That was a sentiment going around that this show is maybe trying to encapsulate. Or it could be a Roddenberry thing that is just like, I don't know, you know, well, these simple lives.
I've posited the theory before, and I don't know if it's ever been made. I mean, knowing his personality, this feels very believable to me. But I think based on this and also the episode last season where there was like that weird native witch character that was like beguiling Kirk or whatever.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I think he has a fetish for some sort of like native, you know, sort of like trapped in a native culture thing where he falls in love with a beautiful woman from that culture.
Okay.
Like, I think that makes him horny specifically.
Maybe. And also maybe we're projecting a little bit here, but
it's not hard.
You know, that's what we're here to do. Maybe the part where the advanced, civilization comes in and woos the simpler people. You know?
God. And they really hammer that shit as soon as Kirk goes sideways in this, because it is every day, every opportunity. Even with amnesia, for him to be superior to them in knowledge and capability in every way possible.
What do you call it? Lamp? You've made lamp?
My God, this changes everything.
Like, they've never seen something like a lamp before.
But that's where this episode was not as offensive as I sort of feared it would be going into it. I had seen it a really long time ago, did not remember much about it. It's only like halfway to as offensive as it could be, but the thing that is offensive is this notion that because these native peoples in their state that they were in when they were brought to this planet were at that stage of development, they never advance anything.
No. I think aside from some of the stuff we've talked about already that is, you know, the fourth wall breaking offensive.
Yeah.
Is the part where the current I don't know, he's like the medicine man, but he's also the keeper of secrets, right? The current one.
The handsome lunghead.
Yeah. His dad didn't want to pass the secret onto him before he died, so this guy just doesn't want to know. Like, that part of just like, well, we're kind of all boned because I was too much of an idiot to take the responsibility on here.
It's just a lot of like, we are trying to write our way out of this already bad screenplay into just making some of this make sense, and none of it ever really works. It's just everything about this culture just feels so hastily slapped together.
Yes, it is. Again, I think this episode is just very boring.
Yeah, and it also is one of my least favorite Star Trek tropes, which is the amnesia plotline. I think you can have interesting amnesia storylines in media if you find a way to make the mystery of the amnesia interesting. like, in the Bourne Identity, him learning who he is actually kind of the thrust of that entire story, and it works to a point. But in a show like this, where you know these characters, all you end up with is a situation where you are just looking at your watch, waiting for them to get to the part where they remember who they are, because everything in between is just frustrating.
Well, okay. Look, you guys will be the experts on this. I'm a passenger here on this one, but, like, this to me, feel free to disagree, but this to me feels about two or three steps, long strides, away from that Picard flute. Like, I lived 100 years in this civilization.
I thought of the inner light a bit as, I mean, this is like miles away from that, though.
This is the Wario to that episode's Mario, yes.
But, like, you know, if they had touched on the device gives you amnesia so that you can live a walk a day in the shoes of this culture, or like it's an intent, right, to do this so that you can carry this with you beyond the stars, you advance civilization that somehow made it into this chamber.
Nope.
None of that,
because what happens is profoundly stupid. And I'm not even talking about the big monolith they discover. Like, I should say that's, like, not a terrible piece of set design for this era and this budget of Star Trek. Like, they actually built something for this, so good for them. But then discovering this monolith, discovering this native culture on this planet, that the biology of this place appears to be very Earth-like, whether the aliens also planted a bunch of our trees there or what, I don't know. But either way, it's Earth-like. But what happens is Kirk goes off by himself on this away mission, touches the monolith, happens to, and as we learn later on, it is literally just pure happenstance. He says into his communicator in a sort of half sing-songy way,
"Kirk to Enterprise."
"Yes, sir."
That musical accompaniment is all it takes to open up the secret hatch on that monolith. He stumbles down into it, wakes up, randomly touches a control panel, and then is shot with mind electricity because he hit the wrong buttons.
Yep.
Don't they know the asteroid is en route at the beginning of this episode?
They do.
I normally don't go too hard on characters making bad decisions, but like they start the episode with existential time pressure.
Yes.
And then Kirk is like, "I'm just going to go look at this strange alien obelisk one more time by myself."
Yep.
Before we need to get back to the ship and deal with this asteroid. It's like, this could not be more ham-fisted.
He's literally just going to paw at it for a couple of minutes.
Right,
why?
Like, just about getting him into trouble.
But again, like, think of that, the sequence of events and like the quickness with which they happen. It's like a Jerry Lewis routine that he's doing. And it literally is like, why is that beam there? Like, why is there a button that erases your memory on this console that's supposed to deflect asteroids?
The defense mechanism so nobody messes around with the, I don't know. He says it later on. It's like, be careful. It's got some kind of protection mechanism.
I think what Spock literally says is, you must have activated a mind beam.
I must have hit something accidentally. The beam caught me, and that's when I stopped remembering.
Probably a memory beam. You must have activated it out of sequence.
Mind beam. All right. Look, this is me doing the thing again where it's just like, I know it's plot science, but could they not track him?
You would think.
Did they not track his communicator? Isn't that what they always do? Like, get a fix on my communicator. Let's go.
I think he pretty conspicuously left that stuff underground in the thing.
No, when Spock and Bones are like, he's missing. We have to just leave.
He's still inside. And so yep. I think they can't penetrate whatever is inside that thing.
Oh, they
can't penetrate the dome?
Yeah. Sure. Okay. I mean, it's not a great explanation, but I think that is their explanation.
Okay.
Is they can't detect him when he's inside that thing.
Okay, and then once he's out, you can't just get a bead on a person, or they're gone by then,
no,
I guess.
Because sensor technology at this stage has not gotten to the point where you can just detect any individual life form easily.
Okay.
Your communicator could be detected, I believe, and certain technology things on you can be, but if you don't know where to look for life signs, it's actually a lot harder than it is in, like, TNG, I think.
Okay, so look, that's a reasonable explanation.
But it doesn't explain anything that happens after this, by any stretch.
No, this episode makes perfect sense now.
No.
Got it. Best episode.
So, amnesia beam happens to him. They go back to the ship, Bones and Spock, because they have to go stop this asteroid, and Spock's whole thing is like...
Doctor, assume this is the planet we're on. This is the approaching asteroid. If we don't get to that deflection point in time, it will become physically impossible to divert this asteroid. In that case, everyone on this planet will die, including the captain.
Can a few more minutes matter, Spock?
In the time it has taken me to explain the problem, the asteroid has moved from here to here. The longer we delay, the less the likelihood of being able to divert it.
Fair point on his, to his degree.
Very logical.
Very funny that he has to literally do, like, a model workup for Bones.
His little pantomime with the rocks is, it's like, in the time we've been talking, it's now, it's just, come on, man.
This very is your illustrative. Brain. This is your brain on asteroid.
Yeah.
But then, you know, Kirk stumbles out there, the comely native lasses happen to be walking by, and of course they think he's a god.
Who are you?
We are your people. We've been waiting for you to come to us.
Yeah, I mean, he walked out of the obelisk.
He's
no
got a
other
weird
reason.
Outfit. He's white. Yeah. What else could he be?
Well, right. Well, there was some prophecy, right? The return.
There's
that somebody
a
would stumble
prophecy,
out of there.
Man. Yeah. Yeah, so eventually some god will come down from the heavens to stop whatever the big disaster they're expecting is. The big disaster, the question I have is that because this planet is just lousy with asteroid problems, or is that because the alien just told them eventually an asteroid is coming?
Also, if this protector race is spreading these civilizations around to protect them, why deposit them on a planet that is prone to asteroid strikes?
Yeah. There's a lot of things that maybe don't make a lot of sense about the protector's whole deal, if you think about it for more than 5 seconds.
Yeah, or that they've never seen this before.
Yeah. Now, the thing that I'll give this episode is that it goes there eventually, but in the initial wave, when Kirk is first brought in to the tribe and saves that one kid's life with CPR, you know, the godly power of CPR, shit, we're all really sad. This kid's dying. And then Kirk just comes in and saves him. He's like, holy shit, dude, you saved him. That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
But then they also, that's immediately when they start spinning into the god territory, and that's where it all goes wrong.
He breathed life back into him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only a god can do that.
Only a god can breathe life into the dead. Do you still question? Give him the medicine badge.
Also, I love this old Mickey Mouse goofy-ass CPR. The pump the legs and the water should just shoot out of the kid's mouth, yep, like a fountain-style version of this. Also, you know, rub the legs, get some blood flowing. Mm-hmm. This is some old-school shit that I adore.
But, you know, it for TV, you kind of got to play it up that way, you know, to really emphasize what he's doing there. But it's just like, okay, so you breathe life into that one kid. I guess you're the medicine man now. Hey, dude, give him your fucking head sash.
Aww.
I almost feel bad for him in this moment. I don't after this, but
I mean, it's not only give him your head sash, it's also give him your betrothed. Yeah, this woman who was going to marry you.
Yes, Miramani has been promised to the medicine man, whoever that is. Like, whoever that person is in the tribe, like, that's just part of their structure.
And she dumps his ass immediately. She's like, what am I going to do, marry you? I'm going to marry a god. What are you talking about?
We should be working on our ritual cloak.
There will be no ritual between us now, Salish.
What do you mean? We cannot go against tradition.
It is because of tradition that I cannot marry you.
But you are promised to me.
That was before he came.
Tribal priestess and medicine chief are always joined.
He is medicine chief now. Salish, choose another. Any maiden would be honored to join with you.
I wish no other.
It is like maybe 2% sad about it at most.
She does not care.
No.
And we should mention there is some dumb time spent at the beginning of this for kind of no reason, that like maybe Kirk is a little susceptible because people under pressure have this Tahiti syndrome that is they see a paradise and there's no pressure of command. Meanwhile, he's going to become a god, which has all the pressure of, like, even more pressure because he has to save an entire peoples. But, like, you know, this idea that, just relax poolside and, you know, live a simple life.
I mean, I get it to a point. Like, they're really hammered this season, and I feel like at the end of last season, the starship captain is very stressed out thing. Like, that keeps coming up in a way that makes me think that this is actually just Roddenberry being like, being a showrunner is really fucking hard and I'm tired and I'm just going to work this out through Kirk.
Well, also we know from multiple episodes and the next episode that his biggest fear is losing command. So
yes,
we don't know what he would even be without command.
Not a great situation. Now, the other time pressure here is the asteroid. They rush out to go. They have to. There's a point, you know, sort of like the movie Deep Impact. There is a point where they will not be able to deflect the asteroid properly if they don't hit it at that exact point. And the thing I'm trying to figure out is that, like, they delayed a little bit on the planet looking for Kirk, but not that much. The way they're having to burn warp energy to just get to this thing, let alone what they need to use the deflector to try and push it away. Was there ever a plan here?
Yeah, that is a good question, actually.
Rear deflection, Mr. Sulu.
Not enough, Mr. Spock. It's only 0.0013 degrees.
Engineering. Recircuit power to engines. Maximum speed, heading 37, mark 010.
Aye, sir. That heading will put us directly in the asteroid's path, sir.
Correct, Mr. Chekhov. I intend to retreat in front of that asteroid until we can employ all power on phaser beams.
What for?
To destroy it. A narrow beam concentrated on a single spot will split that mass.
It might also cripple the ship. Then we would be crushed by the asteroid.
Incorrect. We'll still be able to get out of its path by use of impulse power.
Jim won't be able to get out of his path.
That, Doctor, is another calculated risk we must take.
Like, did they not know that they were going to need that extra energy to do this?
Really doesn't seem like they spent more than, like, an extra hour down there or something.
At most, yeah. And I understand that there is a, you know, you have a timetable here, but, like, what were you going to, like, you were still going to have to rush out there at some point, even if Kirk was still with you. Like, did you know you were going to need that deflector energy then?
Why come to the planet first? Why wouldn't you just deflect the asteroid first?
And then go what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they had to double check and see if there's anybody on it.
I mean, you can tell there's life signs, at least. You know there's, like, humanoids running around. You just don't know who they are.
Mm.
But this is a great... I will give this episode one thing. This is a particularly great example of Scott just being put upon. Like, just getting beaten from all angles. Like, I need more power for this. I need more power for that. Him longingly looking out at those, like, force perspective engine tubes.
Yeah.
And just being like, oh, they're killing my child here, man. Oh,
my bairns.
Yeah, my bairns.
You don't tell Spock no.
No, but, like, Spock's not doing this well, is the thing.
He's kind of losing it a little bit. Like, he's got to think. He's in his, like, meditative state, don't bother me bones.
Like, I don't think Spock should be infallible. I think Spock should be able to make mistakes. But the thing is, they don't really come around on any of that here. It's more just like, yeah, Bones kind of yells at him because he did kind of mess up. And then nothing is really learned after that. He just figures something out because he's Spock.
He's taking calculated risks. Sometimes they work out. Sometimes they don't.
Well, your calculated risk probably just killed our captain.
Oops. You may be right.
I don't know.
Your calculated risk means it now takes 2 months to fly back to the planet.
Yep. No, you mean to moonwalk back to the planet?
During which time you are not going to sleep at all, apparently. You're just going to stay up for 2 months trying to decipher this thing.
It's that Vulcan metabolism, man.
There is also a dumb thing in this episode that I don't know if it ever shows up later or has shown up before, but I only noticed it here. Sulu gets some kind of device that comes in from out of frame as he's
tracking. That's been
tracking
around. They just haven't used it that
okay.
much. Yeah.
I love dumb stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. Just like, because it does slowly come up. Somebody had to build that prop, mm-hmm. you know, that slowly moves up onto his thing for no reason, but good for them.
I think that's supposed to be like part of his like course plotting thing. There's another one in the next episode where he just turns a dial that's sort of down at the bottom.
Yeah, that looks like a ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
But again, there's like almost nothing for any of this, like the subcast to be doing in this episode at all. Like they're just kind of there. And I don't want to spend too much time lingering on the stuff that happens on the planet because very little actually takes place until the big kind of conflict. Like he falls in love with Miramani. Big fucking shock. You know, beautiful woman on a planet, Kirk. Who would guess?
He gets very happy, and you get some great mugging.
Oh, the bit where he just puts his arms out and he's like, ah, he hugs the paradise himself planet. And
then, I know. He's just so happy. Who could even be this happy?
I have found paradise. Surely no man has ever attained such happiness.
He's so happy he grows out his sideburns to look like a mini Glenn Danzig.
I was going to say, I think the most dramatic thing about this whole sequence is the slow growth of his sideburns from the little, like, finally kind of sculpted triangular sideburns he's usually doing to, like, full-on mutton chops by the end.
As mutton choppy as he is capable of getting, absolutely. But it's just, like, the stuff with him and Miramini, it's, like, it's not awful, but the actress is somewhat limited. I don't feel like there's actually a lot of chemistry between them, other than I bet William Shatner is definitely attracted to this woman in real life. And I just think all the stuff with the dipshit boyfriend and Medicine Man, it's just death. Like, every part of it is just kind of death, because he's not a great actor.
Why are you not at the temple, Kirok? Soon the ground will begin to tremble. The people need your help.
We'll go to the caves. It'll be safe there.
The caves? Surely a legend can do more than that for his people.
When the ground trembles, the caves are not safe, Kirok. If you do not rouse the temple spirit, we will all die.
There is nothing you cannot do, my husband.
Well, what do you wait for, God? Your robes?
Yeah, there's not a lot of, like, flair to the love story, because it's all very mechanical, because she is written so one-dimensionally, you know? Like, she barely seems to have any agency.
Yeah, if at all, yeah.
Like, she is just basically like, I'm promised to whoever the medicine man is, and it's you now, so hey, I'm gonna bear you sons.
Yeah.
Time to get married. Like, that's kind of the extent of it. Like, it really does sort of feel like Roddenberry wish fulfillment kind of thing.
And, with the power of the lamp. Lamp?
Lamp?
Which turns night into day, we can cook twice as much food, and as you taught us,
preserve.
Preserve. For times of famine. So that is why you made the lamp, Kirok, so that I would never know when it was night and I would be forever cooking.
Oh, no. No. That's not why I made the lamp at all, to keep you forever cooking.
You know, like, again, the stuff with Salish is really bad. The knife fight is especially fucking just pathetic in terms of both staging and execution. But the one thing they do, though, is they set up something that actually feels like it should have consequences, which is that Kirk impregnates this woman.
Yeah.
They're going to have a kid.
Yeah.
Now, I did the timeline work on this. And by that, I mean I read a little bit. As of this moment, in the official Star Trek timeline, Kirk already has a kid. He just doesn't know it yet.
Oh, the kid that comes back in the movies?
Carol Marcus's kid, yes. Okay. So the one that shows up in Wrath of Khan and all that stuff, like, that whole deal. That has already happened at this point in the timeline, but Kirk doesn't know anything about it. Okay. So theoretically, this would be the first time he has ever thought he has gotten someone pregnant and might have a kid.
Well,
or at least Kirok thinks that.
Yes, Kirok thinks that.
Let's hope he can someday move on from this.
He moves on by next week.
I would argue he moves on by the credits.
Yeah.
Let's hope that we could
someday. I think he might have been quietly relieved when he realized what had actually happened there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to skip to the end. I guess we'll talk about the final scene when we get there.
You know, while this is going on, he's happy. Like, the whole point is that Kirk is happy because he doesn't know any better, and also he has this life with this woman who is beautiful, who seems to love him. But at some point, he's going to have to do his god business, which is coming up here in a moment. The last thing I want to touch on with the moonwalking back to the planet on the ship, and also just kind of Spock doing his Spock things, trying to figure out the right thing. I love some good Bones and Spock jawing back and forth. None of it is in this episode. Mm-hmm. Everything, their dialogue in this is just tedious. The whole thing of him being like, okay, I'll go rest, so I'll go lay on my bed, and then as soon as you walk out of the room, I'm going right back to my chair to keep thinking. It's not that funny. And him just sitting there plucking at the harp is like, again, none of it really goes anywhere. It's just Spock is stubborn and going to do what he's going to do. That's it. That's the whole bit.
Yeah, there's no consequence for him burning himself out.
No. If anything, he was right, I guess.
Yeah.
I prescribed sleep. You prescribed rest, Doctor. The symbols on the obelisk are not words. They are musical notes.
Musical notes? You mean it's nothing but a song?
In a way, yes. Other cultures, among them certain Vulcan offshoots, use musical notes as words. The tones correspond roughly to an alphabet.
Were you able to make any sense out of the symbols?
Yes, the obelisk is a marker, just as I thought. It was left by a super race known as the Preservers. They passed through the galaxy rescuing primitive cultures which were in danger of extinction and seeding them, so to speak, where they could live and grow.
I've always wondered why there were so many humanoids scattered through the galaxy.
So have I. Apparently, the preservers account for a number of them.
That's probably how the planet has survived all these centuries. The preservers put an asteroid deflector on the planet.
Which has now become defective and is failing to operate.
And we have to find that deflector and put it back into working order. Otherwise...
Precisely, Doctor.
But, man, it's time for God time.
This is the reason for the season, Karak. It's time to...
It is 25% more windy and there's some dust in the air. That must mean that the fucking apocalypse is coming.
Is the asteroid doing this?
Yeah, what triggers the storm? I don't remember if there is an inciting event.
It is the implication that the asteroid is close, and I assume that they are basing this off the fact that weather patterns would be affected by, like, the gravitational force of a giant asteroid coming at a planet, etc. They've shown this in other Star Trek things where, like, something is bearing down on a planet and the weather gets weird. I assume there must be some science behind that.
Sure, yeah, I can see that.
But it's barely depicted. Like, the wind machine is, like, halfway on through a lot of this.
I do, okay, there is a couple of things in this episode that I chuckled at. One is when he does the, like, smug hugging himself, I'm so happy. The other one is when they're like, hey, the skies are darkening, the ground trembling, it's, like, time to go. And he's like, wait, what now?
What do I do?
He's like, wait, what do you want?
What do I do?
Let's just go to the caves or something. He'd be like, no, dude, no, your whole thing is go back in the obelisk and stop.
Do you know how they do that? Do you have, like, an instruction manual?
He seems genuinely like, I was just kind of here to marry the beautiful woman.
And, yeah.
Maybe make lamps. Geez, what time is it? I got to...
Look, it's all awful, but I will give this. The shot of him in the dusty wind just pounding on that model.
I cannot take Shatner seriously when he bellows like that. I'm just, I don't know.
I mean, you shouldn't. There's nothing to take seriously. He's being a huge ham. Honey glazed.
You always wonder if, like, on set after that, are people clapping? You know, are they
yeah,
like,
yeah, good, great.
Yeah, no, that was beautiful.
You're getting an Emmy for this one, bud.
Or are they laughing, right? Are they like, yeah, that was really goofy? Or are they like, it was so good. It was so emotional. You really were Karak at that moment. I felt it.
I don't know. I think they were just happy to get done with this episode based on what I've read.
Turn the wind machines off.
Yeah, no one was real happy during any of this season, but. But again, so, like, he can't get in there because he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. Spock has learned on the planet, or on the ship, he has figured out that the symbols on this thing are actually musical notes and that this is a thing, you know, like, there's a whole musical element to opening the thing, but Kirk doesn't know any of this right now. So he can't get in. Miramani's like, no, he's still, you know, don't hurt him, whatever. But then, of course, the natives have to come and stone the fucking heathens to death, right?
Die with your false god.
Like, come on.
Throw your styrofoam rocks at him. And it's funny because the editing here is so... Once she gets up on the thing, again, I don't know if this is why this happens or not, but it's so frantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just imagined it's because her little tiny skirt keeps blowing up and showing her butt and the sensors couldn't allow... Because the wind machine is pumping and she's up there and they just cut every half a frame, you know, back and forth between everything. And then find until she's on the ground and, like, be like, thank yeah. God.
With zero bruises, by the way, for all these heavy stones that are being hucked at her. Not a single one has left a mark.
It's all internal, Alex, okay?
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, look, don't worry, because Spock and Bones are here just in time to beam in and chase off, you know, the angry natives. And then they beam Nurse Chapel down, which they don't do a lot. So I'll at least give them that. They at least got her involved in a way she normally is not. To come down there and just very gravely say, she ain't going to make it.
Well, they inject them both. They give them the juice.
Well, they give them the juice, but then we also have a mind meld. We have to do a little mind meldy.
This whole last sequence is just so limp. Like, there's so little drama
frantic.
To any of it. Maybe mind melding with him will fix his amnesia. Oh, it did. Okay. Maybe pressing these buttons will stop the asteroid. Oh, it did. All right, we're done.
Maybe injecting her with our space medicine will stop her from dying.
Nope.
Oh.
Nope.
So we don't have to worry about him being married or having a kid?
Apparently not.
Well, okay, well, that works out.
Yeah, because again, the sequence of events here is they save his life, they mind meld with him. There's a little bit of Spock going, "I am the Rock," and all that, like it's fucking Cobra or something.
I'm the Rock.
Spock. What is it?
His mind. He's an extremely dynamic individual.
And then the Nurse Chapel has to be like, "Ah, she ain't gonna make it, man." But they do get into the monolith. They figure out the technology pretty quickly, yeah, I'm gonna say.
Not tough.
To hit the beam that makes the asteroid go askew. And then they come out and they have to undo all the consequences of everything that has happened with Kirk on the planet.
That's right, they have to erase
it. We have to kill our guest star.
We will live long and happy lives. I will bear you many strong sons. I love you always.
And I love you, Miramani. Always.
Like, I think this death scene is, like, actually okay in concept. I just don't think Shatner plays it with the, I don't know, the poignancy that I would expect.
It's not a lot of gravity to it.
Yeah. Yeah, like he, I mean, like, I don't know, he's like, he's kind of there for her and, like, gives her a moment before she passes, right?
But, yeah.
But I don't see the, he's not stricken in the way that I would expect, like, a really meaningful ending to this episode to portray him as.
I mean,
like, not to keep comparing it to other Star Treks, but, like, I don't think this is how, like, a Patrick Stewart or somebody of that caliber of acting ability would play this, you know?
Yeah, no, I think they try to give this some weight, because this is kind of a wild, terrible thing to happen to someone, but they're playing it very much as Kirk just only now realizes all of this is happening, because he has sort of got his memory back. He probably remembers what happened, but he doesn't really, like, it isn't really connected in a Kirk way yet. So he's just realizing, oh, I'm actually not having a kid because this woman's going to die. I'm sure he's a lot of weird emotions about this. It's just that none of that really comes through in with Shatner at all in this actual performance.
Whether or not he truly loves her by the end of this, the Kirk version of this character truly loves him, or is just telling her what he, you know,
I think
what
he's in horniness with her. I don't think he's in love.
But, like, I never know where Star Trek medicine is at. Sometimes it feels like they have magic wand capability. Mm-hmm. They can transplant a brain from somebody to another person.
It really stuck out to me that they didn't ever bother to transport her to the ship, apparently.
Nope. Like,
where they're able to, like, seemingly put people in stasis all the time and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, like, regrow organs and do all sorts of things. But here, we're gonna let this one go.
It is notable that I will say there are definitely people even in later Star Trek that do die of internal injuries that are too severe for their medicine to deal with. So that is not totally out of the realm of possibility, but I agree with you. I feel like the correct move would have been, let's try. Let's right, try and yeah, see what happens.
No, maybe there's a... Maybe there's some kind of bro code where they're just like, no, this one's beyond... Are you Nurse Chapel? Like, are you sure we could take? No, she's a Ixnay on the same thing.
But it's like, not like there's some like royal lineage he's trying to get away from. Like, that kid isn't going to inherit the starship, you know, if he comes looking for the claim.
No,
he's
attachments. Just be... We talk about this. This is off camera.
Also, they're human, so you're not really interfering in another culture here.
Well, they also do not go back into any of the other peoples of this planet after the savior.
Oh, they're gone. They just left. They're not like those TPs are basically empty at this point. Who knows where they are now?
Yeah, like who gets the medicine badge at this point? Do we need to pass this knowledge along in case the machine breaks again? Are we done?
It's just so unceremonious because she dies, you know, and there's like, you know, Kirk's holding her in his arms. And then it's just produced by Fred Freiberger. Like, that's it. That's the end of the show and the scene. And there's no addressing of it after.
I think a very small thing that I think they do well is they don't cut to freeze frame. During the credits, it is still rolling during those initial credits of Kirk holding her. And I think that lets the moment breathe out a little bit. And I think that is actually way better than it's cutting to freeze frame of her holding her.
Yeah, you're not wrong. There is, yes. I didn't give it quite as much credit as it deserves.
I think you gave it just about enough.
No, I think it's correct, because I think that is a nice thing. But again, in better Star Trek, and this is the thing you've echoed a lot, Brad. In better Star Trek, there at least would have been a scene where someone talks to Kirk about his emotions of what just took place. You know,
right,
what does this mean to you?
Like a Patrick Stewart or an Avery Brooks would have really given this some gravity in a way that Shatner does not.
He doesn't seem he seems at best mildly tormented by it. But as we know, this will never come up again, not be brought up again. This is just not really a meaningful moment in his character.
Nope. What could have been?
What could have been is a thing we will probably be saying a lot throughout this season. Again, I think this is a bad episode. I think the next episode is actually worse, though. Like, this one's mostly just kind of tedious and kind of a waste of time. It did not actively irritate me the way the next one does.
Yeah, I agree. I think this feels cookie cutter and kind of boring, but the next one just is nonsensical and the next one is a very avoidable problem.
Yes. In so many ways.
In so many ways.
Yeah. I'm going to call this one medium racist and not great, but not the absolute worst thing we've seen yet.
There you go.
All right. Well, we do have one more episode, as we said, and the children shall lead. It's wretched. Let's talk about it when we come back. We're going to take our break. We will be right back. All right, we are back, and the children shall lead us into absolute abject fucking misery. This episode, I'll say it again, I think it is the worst episode of Star Trek we have watched so far of this series.
It's a bold claim.
There have been some bad ones. I think this is the most intolerable one we've done.
It's definitely one of the most frustrating ones, I'll say. It's also pretty boring.
Yeah.
And it also feels like the one that doesn't have any consequence or stakes in it. Like there's
none.
It's you could have resolved this so easily and you just didn't.
There's a lot of choices made by Kirk, by other people on the ship, by the children themselves that just feel like all they are doing is stretching this out as much as possible.
Yeah, like lock the damn kids up. Physically move them into a room. I don't know. Do something. It seems like there's resistance to the mind virus at some point. I'm not sure. They have a couple of threads going on here. There's, if you want to set up the episode before we get into the main plot here,
say what's on your mind.
There's like the anxiety thing that's on the planet, and then
the beast.
The beast, and then there's also the kids who are somehow summoning the power of the ghost marauders through them, or channeling this thing, but they themselves are innocent in the whole equation, apparently. And then there's the part where I have no idea what the goal of this ghost is. What do they want?
Crime? to do riches? Crime again?
To enthrall more people? To what end?
To
get the kids to not have a bedtime? Like, what is the actual goal?
Does that actor seem like horribly miscast to anybody else? Like, it really just, I feel like they just did not get what they needed out of that guy to get any of that across.
Oh, Brad, you didn't learn who this guy is, did you?
I did not.
Great. Then I'm gonna save that for you, and I'm gonna tell you who this actor is. And again, I actually don't think him being in this is the worst thing about it, though he is definitely not a good actor. Anyway, let's just talk about the setup for the episode.
Yeah.
So this episode was written by Edward J. Lasko. This is his only Star Trek episode. He is mostly a TV writer. He is best known as one of the main writing staff on Charlie's Angels. And I do believe that every single person who talks about this episode has basically said that guy was kind of a shitty writer and this episode sucks ass.
Okay.
Except Gene Roddenberry, who liked the pitch for this episode enough that he hired the guy to write the episode.
Okay.
Gene Roddenberry, even though his involvement eventually trails off before these episodes start airing, still out there, a threat, a menace to this show, even when we don't want him to be. The director here is interesting. This is Marvin J. Chomsky, who had a 30-year career as a TV director on shows like Gunsmoke, Hawaii Five-O, and The Wild Wild West. And he is a cousin of Noam Chomsky.
Oh, wild.
Hmm.
I don't. Okay. There's nothing else to say about that okay. other than, huh, okay.
The Chomsky's out there, huh?
Yeah, okay. Apparently. Directing television, of all things. Nimoy straight up says he thinks this is the worst episode they ever did on the series. Mm. Roddenberry does not speak very highly of it, and a big part of that is because of the casting of Gorgon, the Scooby-Doo pirate ghost that has taken over these children's minds. And that...
He is just a dude in fluorescent paint. Just
yeah.
Like-
He's a guy in fluorescent yeah. paint and a giant feathery moo-moo. That is it.
And they pull the mask off at the end, yes. It's just like, oh, yeah.
If resistance mounts, call upon their beasts. Their beast will serve us well. The fear in each one of them is the beast which will consume him. Remember how it was on Triacus? If they resist, so shall it be on the Enterprise. If you need me, call and I will appear.
So the actor who plays Gorgon, you are right, Brad. He seems wildly miscast for this part. And the reason for that is he's not an actor. Mm-hmm. This is Melvin Belly, a criminal defense and personal injury lawyer of the what? Era. There's conflicting reports on this. His son plays the freckle-faced kid that never talks.
Oh, Stevie or something? Whatever. The kid yeah. who gets the other ice cream?
Yes, the one who gets the ice cream, the one who barely has any lines. So that's his son. The thing I can't figure out and the thing that conflicts is I can't tell if the son was cast because Mervyn Belly was brought in or the other way around. Either way, the kid never acted again. This is the only thing he's ever been in. So I don't know what the provenance actually of this guy being in it is. But Mervyn Belly was pretty well known at this point. He defended Jack Ruby in the Lee Harvey Oswald murder Whoa. Trial.
How do you think he handled the case? Mr. Belli, your opinion on Judge Brown?
He went down the line for every motion that the district attorney made, and they led him into some 30 errors. And every Texas jurist knows this thing was the greatest railroading kangaroo court disgrace in the history of American law.
Wow, okay.
He worked for Mick Jagger during the Altamont controversy.
Okay.
So, like, he was a well-known, somewhat celebrity lawyer who also did personal injury stuff in addition to criminal defense. Walter Koenig, in particular, raised many vocal objections about this person being cast. Not because really? He hated the guy, but because he's like, he's not an actor. Why are we doing this? Why are we not giving this to an actual actor?
I mean, why didn't they give it to an actual actor?
I don't know. Somewhere in there, it might have been Fred Freiberger, it might have been one of the other people, they thought the stunt casting would just get people talking about this episode in a way that it wouldn't otherwise. It super did not. Mm. Nobody cared that this guy was in this episode other than to say he's not very good in it. Now, the one thing I will say for him, he had a good attitude about this and apparently was very easy to work with. He did whatever okay. he was directed to do, did not act like, you know, some sort of like a bellicose lawyer personality type on set. He was just happy to be there and did whatever they asked him.
I guess this guy was pretty well known. He was like sort of tangentially involved in the Zodiac affair.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Like the, I'm just very quickly skimming. Like he received a letter purportedly from the Zodiac killer. There was some setup where he was trying to arrange some kind of telephone interview or something, but would only do it if this attorney was present.
Huh.
Basically. Point being, even somebody like the Zodiac killer knew who this guy was.
Yeah. He was on TV, I think,
yeah,
a decent amount.
Yeah, like he clearly was like a public figure of some repute.
And so that guy is in the movie Zodiac, played by Brian Cox in that movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But so he had a really interesting, I'm trying to find his nickname. King of the Torts is what they called him.
Okay. Okay. Like
a tort reform. Is a civil yeah. wrong, which I did not realize. Yeah. I thought that meant something else. Apparently not. Also was married six times in his life.
Okay.
Interesting guy. You should read up on him at some point. But so he is the one playing Gorgon here. Again, nobody speaks very highly of his performance, but by all accounts, he was a nice enough guy. Roddenberry fucking hated his performance in this so much that he forced them to dial up the ethereal, like, wavy effect on him and modulate his voice very heavily to cover up how bad he thought his performance was.
But he he pushed for him, do we know? Like, or was a casting
I don't know
director.
Who it was okay, that okay. actually pushed for him okay. is the thing. I don't, it does not say, and Roddenberry doesn't seem pleased with the decision one way or the other.
I don't think it would have fixed this episode to have a much better actor there, but it definitely would have helped.
It would have helped, because that character just has no gravitas whatsoever whenever he shows up. Some of the kids here, the oldest one, the redhead, Craig Hunley as Tommy, he has been on Star Trek before. It was all the way back in season one, in the episode Operation Annihilate. He played Kirk's nephew in that episode. It was a much smaller part, I believe.
Okay.
This guy is interesting, though. So he didn't have a huge acting career, but he went on to become a composer and a musician. I might have mentioned this the last time he was on the show, just in case I didn't. I'll mention it again. He invented a musical instrument. It is called the blaster beam.
Okay.
It is a very long stringed instrument that basically creates these very strange tonalities that you hear in a lot of sci-fi film, including Star Trek 1 and 2, the movies.
Oh, all right.
So this instrument has been used in a lot of film scores and stuff, and that kind of is the thing he's mostly known for, other than his little bit of an acting career.
Oh, Alex, when you said very long, this is
I mean very,
very
long.
Long.
It's 12, room length.
12 to 18 feet, this says.
Yeah, okay.
This is a serious piece of hardware.
Okay.
The only other child actor who was like kind of a big deal as a child actor is Pamela Ferdin as Mary, the one girl child in this. She almost got the lead part in The Exorcist.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I can see it. Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
Didn't end up getting it, but she did go on to have, you know, a career. And in fact, for 37 years, she was the only actor ever to kill a Clint Eastwood character. In the 1971 movie The Beguiled.
Yeah, okay.
She apparently poisons Clint Eastwood's character in that.
Mm.
Until Gran Torino, no one else had done it. So that's a fun little thing to have on your resume,
totally,
I guess.
Yes.
She also was, and this is just for me, you remember C-Lab 2021? You remember that old Adult Swim show?
Mm-hmm.
She was on C-Lab 2020, the thing they based that show on.
Okay.
I assume it's one of the kid characters.
Sure.
Yeah. But another, so not much of a child acting career here, but Brian Tochi, who plays Ray, the one Asian kid, he had a pretty significant adult acting career. Specifically, he played one of the doctors on Saint Elsewhere. He played Nagata in the Police Academy movies.
Uh-huh.
He was Toshiro in the Revenge of the Nerds movies.
Uh-huh.
He was the voice of Leonardo in the first three TMNT live action movies.
Hell yeah.
And he also has another small part in a TNG episode as an ensign.
Oh.
Night Terrors.
Oh, okay.
I believe that's the one where Troy is having nightmares and no one else can sleep.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Does he play a different character? Did this
No. Because that's like 120 right. years in the future, or some 100
okay.
years in the future or something. So he would definitely be a lot older than that ensign he played.
Oh, okay. All right. Dang it. I thought maybe he came back and did his time in Starfleet after this.
And the other kid, Mark Robert Brown, who plays Don, only ever acted as a child and ceased performing by the next year. So that was this is the extent of his career, basically.
Okay. Is he the one that haunts the engineering?
Yes,
bay?
The one who
okay.
is just who really only does the fist thing, never really talks at all.
No, yeah, right.
Yeah, that's our cast. Again, reception on this one pretty bad, all things considered, both at the time and you know later on. Like nobody speaks well of this episode. And the thing I want to emphasize with this is not me hating kid episodes of Star Trek. I'm actually fairly tolerant of them. I even think some of the TNG kid heavy episodes that people don't like as much, I don't think are as bad as maybe people make them out to be. This one is uniquely irritating in a way that I have a hard time dialing in on exactly what it is, except everything.
I mean, the kids here are used mostly as caricatures of children
to
be
they're shitty little puppets basically.
Yeah. I don't think it's the fault of the child actors or anything. I think they're doing well enough by the
they're doing what they're being told to
acting.
Do. Yeah. No, the problem is what they've written for them, which is they are immediately unpleasant and off-putting, obviously because they are being influenced by something evil. But there's just like the amount of time they spend with them just completely no selling any grief for their parents being dead does not endear them to an audience, even if you know they're being affected by something.
They also just don't act like kids. Like they act like ideas of kids and not kids.
They're
like
demons.
I thought this was going to be a possession story. I thought they themselves were going to be like alien in some way.
Right. Like they've been replaced or something.
Right. Like they've been possessed by some alien consciousness or something like that. Would be a lot more monstrous than what we've got here.
No, the ghost alien just offered them some candy or something, and they were like, "Cool, yeah, kill our parents."
I assume they're under the same thrall and seeing visions and but they have some kind of agency. It's not very clear. Yeah, and
the nature of the influence is bad.
That's hopefully this was not at the point when I was slightly nodding off, but like I just don't feel like they sell what was in the bargain for them here. Exactly.
No bedtime.
Right. Like I'm not sure how exactly did you. I don't know if it's even productive questioning the decisions of characters in fiction, but like the parents just like they elected to kill themselves, right? Like they
were being influenced too. I know they were. It was the anxiety that was doing it.
Right. But it's like I feel like that one recording they found, like they basically say they have to kill themselves because they're being controlled, right? Like they still consciously decided to do that.
I even went so far as to call Starfleet Command to request a spaceship to be used as a transport. It was only when I couldn't tell them what I wanted to transport that I began to realize that my mind was being directed. I decided to send a dispatch to Starfleet, warning them. God forgive us. We must destroy ourselves. Alien upon us. The enemy from within. The enemy!
Something about that, maybe not getting off planet or something, like a ship is coming.
Yeah, I guess so, but like, I don't know,
Yeah, it's not clear.
Then he's the only parent here, but like the idea that a bunch of parents would just kill themselves and strand their children on an alien planet voluntarily instead of doing literally everything else they could to try to solve this problem just seems kind of insane to me.
I would have to assume it's part of whatever glamour was over them. Maybe they thought the kids didn't exist anymore, or the kids were dead. Right.
Then why did the script not go as far as to just say the children influenced their parents to kill themselves? But maybe that is just a bridge too far for what they're doing here.
I think they do. I think they do. They do kind of intimate that.
They do. So I think what is happening here, and again, it isn't clearly defined, but I think what is happening is that there is a split. They talk about like the way that the Gorgon, when he actually talks about what they are planning to do later. There's an implication, I think, there that the effects this force, whatever the fuck you want to call it, these aliens have on people. Some of them respond in a way that is very much just like, I'll do whatever you want. Let's do it. Let's go. The ones that don't, the ones that resist, that's the one they dial up the beast in, whatever their greatest fears, their anxieties are. And those are the ones that they just get rid of because they can affect them this way. So I don't know if there is an actual split, if it's a personality type thing, if it's a genetic thing, or if it's just the ones that are more easily influenced, they can, like the kids. He can just make them do whatever he wants versus the ones that are harder to influence. He's just dialing up the kill yourself juice on them.
And I think there's something from the doctor later on, which is actually maybe the only, that part is the only kind of truly thinkable moment. Like, that's weird. Is when the doctor's like, I didn't even realize I was calling a shuttle to like take us off the planet until they asked why. And then like, this is why we need to off ourselves, because I'm not in control anymore. Like I've lost control, and it's manipulating us in ways that I can't even control anymore. And I don't even know when I'm not in control. I think that part, it's like, oh yeah, that's kind of scary. This doctor is like the only, in my moment of clarity. I mean, maybe the doctor gave the poison out to the other people. They don't really go too deep into it.
It's just not well defined. Yeah. And the bigger thing is that, the thing that actually pisses me off about this setup and where it actually goes is I actually think the opening of this episode is one of the better, more effective, creepy things they do on Star Trek, the original series. It's just that after that opening and the original credits, it all completely falls apart after that.
All this self-inflicted. Mass suicide.
Showing up on this planet, expecting to find a science team, and finding all these people dead, lying around like they just fucking, they were waiting for the Hale-Bopp comet. Like, it's actually kind of creepy and fucked up in a way that I was willing to go along with until other things started happening.
Until these kids in their space boots.
Yeah. God, those boots, man. What are those boots?
The shiny vinyl boots. Your clubbing boots.
That was the space 60s. I did find the one... recording from the scientist guy that I was looking for. He basically just says, we must destroy ourselves, the enemy from within, alien among us type thing. So it does kind of seem like they basically just, like, I guess you mentioned this, like they decided to just take themselves out to stop this thing from spreading or whatever.
But you're right in that, like, they don't, like, one line from them being like, they've already gotten the children, right? Like,
right.
Something that just addresses, right, like leaving the kids behind for some reason.
But, okay. The other thing is that they never address what it is that they actually, like you said, what are the kids getting out of any?
Yeah, it's just the seduction aspect of this is just completely, like, missing. I started to say implausible, but for something to be plausible, it has to be present. You know, like, I feel like there's just kind of nothing there. I mean, like, they love ice cream, I guess, but they're getting plenty of that on the starship.
Yeah. Like, I think the thing that you need from this is you need some of those tapes to be, like, the scientist guy admonishing his kid for bothering him while he's doing his scientific work.
Right.
Something that just emphasizes the fact that, like, you know, these aren't evil parents, but they're busy parents. They're doing things that the kids don't like and are frustrating them in some way, because otherwise these kids just sound like mutants.
Like, you can definitely write, you can do corrupted children well, and that can be very disturbing if it's done well, but it's kind of, like, just not done at all here.
No.
And they've done it multiple times. We've had plenty of, like, children with amazing power episodes of Star Trek where, like, you know, it was a Charlie
X, yep.
Charlie X. We've had aliens that are really children, you know, that have amazing powers, right? But they're children, the dude who captures them and makes them play things. All these episodes. This one is just... it's ill-defined, and the goals are not well and clear here.
No.
The omnipotent, like, malevolent presence here that could do whatever is not defined for what it wants. It's the whole thing is just bizarre. And the resolution is bizarre.
I actually found quite a few instances of the repeated mind control to be just kind of tedious. Like, it feels like that spins its wheels for way too much of the episode. Like, Scotty trying to divert the ship, and these red shirts, you know, getting into it with him, and then later he's mine, you know, like, too many instances of children pumping their fist to make somebody do something, and it just kind of goes nowhere.
Like, that's the thing I was going to get to, is that it's not, and sometimes when we talk about stuff like this in Star Trek episodes, there just isn't that much room for them to slide other things into the episode. Like, you know, sometimes these episodes are stretched out, but you just can't find, like, an easy, natural point for them to do the things that we talk about that would make it better. I get it. You know, you have 50 minutes, you got to do your stuff. 35 minutes of this episode could just be cut and replaced with something else, and it would not make any difference at all.
Or even, like, the crew kind of losing their minds, like Uhura glimpsing her own death, and, like, the Sulu,
it's so,
like,
long.
The Sulu, like, knives in space thing.
Oh, my God.
It's just so interminable. It just goes on and on.
And not scary. Like, the makeup on Uhura is definitely kind of disturbing, but none of it is really that terrifying.
Like, how many different times do they cut back to that sequence of the... I don't know what this looked like in the original, or maybe that is the original
effect.
That
is how it looked in the original.
Disregard what you see on the screen, what you think you see on the screen. Set a course for Starbase 4.
Like, just this sequence of knives flying at the ship over and over.
Helmsman, did you hear me? Yes, sir.
And I look, here's where it really, like I said, the opening shot I think is good and creepy. Finding the science team all dead, you know, like they just walked in on, you know, at the end of a cult or something is pretty haunting. But then they come back from credits and they have their shitty little United Federation of Planets banner.
I know.
They put down next to these graves.
Like, there's a 50% off sale at the
it's
at the
so
job
bad.
Lot. It's really, this is how we're going to honor them.
Put a wavy tube man up next to those graves, I guess. So, I don't know.
It's so just, I don't know. I mean, guess what else are you going to do with this little banner? Like, there's a garage sale around the corner, or like the worst, like 1960s
open
Captain
house,
America
come check
shield.
It out.
Yeah. It's just like, okay, look. But they do have stones in it. Yeah,
especially
because,
like, the headstones have this, like, kind of nice... kind of classy mid-century science fiction look to them.
But I guess you need something for the kids to knock over to show how much they just don't care.
and they don't care
flag. They
at
just
all.
Don't care. No,
they're playing Ring Around the Rosie. They're fucking around in their shiny HMS Pinafore boots or whatever the hell they're wearing, and just could not possibly be even remotely bothered by the fact that their parents are dead.
No, they basically are. I mean, they're not rude kids, but they just don't seem to care.
No sign of grief.
No, Jim. No indication of any kind.
Or of fear.
They seem completely secure and unafraid.
And you insist that their behavior is a sign of traumatic shock?
I don't insist, Jim, but I can't dismiss the possibility.
Child suppresses the fact that both parents are dead. I can't believe it.
Humans do have an amazing capacity for believing what they choose and excluding that which is painful.
Not these children to this extent. It's incredible.
What those children saw is incredible, Jim. The way those deaths occurred, any reaction is possible, including lacunar amnesia. That's my diagnosis. Until specific tests can be made, it remains that.
I'll be guided by that opinion, Doctor, for the present. What about questioning them?
Not until the fabric of the traumatization weakens, or you can come up with another explanation for their behavior. Forcing them to see this experience now could cause permanent damage.
Accepted, Doctor.
And I think another big miss for me is this part where they go into the cave and, like, there's stuff in there. There's, like, scientific equipment and stuff, and they're getting weird readings about anxiety or whatever. And you're like, okay, maybe somewhere deep in here is where they're going to find whatever this force is or whatever. Nope, that's the last time we're there. Don't care about it. Not important. Apparently, as soon as these kids are off the planet, so is the fucking pirate ghost. So here we go.
That's very strange. I'm getting a feeling of anxiety in this place. It doesn't sound very scientific, does it? But it's strongest right here.
I'm not aware of it, Captain.
Maybe that's what's registering on your tricorder.
I am not familiar with anxiety, but I was not aware that it could be registered on sensors.
No. Of course, that's... that's me. It's me. But what's causing your tricorder to react?
Yeah, right. We don't. Well, I think they. I think Kirk thinks that there's another part here, which is just bananas. But I do think Kirk thinks that another part of the security detail is investigating it when he abandons the planet. Or
yes, that part.
But Sulu is, when he's like, all right, beam up the other team. What now?
Huh?
Fuck, maybe we should have, maybe next time. Okay, new
Let's
rule.
Check those coordinates next time.
Next time we open the window before we do any beaming down.
Beaming two men randomly into space is genuinely
up.
One of the darker
is
things they do.
The creepy is probably the actually most creepy affecting thing in this episode to me.
Just dispersing your atoms into...
awful. Like, probably presumably, they just materialized in space and just died instantly.
Ugh.
And again, it's another thing that's like, it happens, and then Kirk's like, ah, shit, I killed two guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on.
Damn kids.
Well, I mean, they are taking over the ship.
Yeah.
Like, there are stakes here.
I mean, so early on when they're on the ship, they're just kind of acting, like we said, like indifferent little assholes about the fact that their parents are dead. The ice cream bit is a little interesting in that it feels like they are teasing out the idea that these kids want to get what they want at all costs, but they don't really do anything with it. Like, there's just a little bit of like a knowing look toward Nurse Chapel during the sequence and the bit with Kirk when he comes in to talk to them. But there isn't really that much menace established here. It's just kind of like these kids are a little off. That's it.
It's better than Triacus, isn't it?
That dirty old planet.
What's so good about that place?
Yeah. You weren't there very long. You don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't think your parents liked it very much either.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, mine sure did. Parents like stupid things.
Oh, I don't know about that. Parents like children.
Huh. That's what you think.
I'm sure your parents loved you. That's why they took you with them to Triacus. So they wouldn't be so far away from you for such a long time. That would make them very unhappy and they'd miss you. I'm sure that you would miss them too.
No, that comes when Marlon Brando ghost shows up after Kirk kind of leaves them. they all do their little ring around the Rosie thing to summon the large feathery man in green, and that is the first time we encounter this guy.
You have done very well, my friends. You have done what must be done. You have come aboard the Enterprise. Now, our destination is a Federation settlement. Captain Kirk will undoubtedly choose a closer station. Do not let that deter you. Marcus 12 has millions of people on it. Nearly a million will join us as our friends. The rest will be our enemies. Together with our other friends who will join us, we will defeat our enemies as we defeated them on Triacus. Million friends on Marcus will make us invincible. No one will tell us where to go, when to sleep, where to eat. The universe will be mine to command, yours to play in. To accomplish this great mission, we must first control the Enterprise. To control the ship, we first must control the crew. You know how to do that. That is your next task. And as you believe, so shall you do. So shall you do. As you believe, so shall you do. So shall you do. As you believe.
I do like their attempt here at the Roseanne table shot with the camera in the middle, but it doesn't quite work. They haven't quite figured out how to do it. Like, the direction is not really clear on whether they should be looking at the camera, look away from the camera. It's really, it's an interesting shot that doesn't quite make it.
And this man does not read as ageless space pirate. I'm going to say it. He has a little bit more of a high school principal vibe going on.
Yeah. Yeah, his cloak is real nice, though.
What you can see of it, I guess. It's very billowy. That's really all I have to say about it, is that he's just a big billowy man.
So I guess he wants to rule the universe and the...
I guess.
But, like, what? To what end?
I mean, I don't know. Even his plot is not well established, necessarily. Like, he wants to take over this planet. Or at least some of the people on the planet, but not all of them. They'll kill the rest, I guess.
No bedtime.
Yeah, so, but, like... He was found on this planet. The kids found him. Kids are doing his bidding. He knows about this other planet that apparently he knows the Starfleet name of. Was it like Marcus 12 or whatever?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I don't know how he knows that ship, but I'll just go with it. Maybe he had a different name when he was marauding. But again, his whole thing is, I'm going to build my new space army. I'm going to fucking have my Lord of the Rings army of the dead. But you kids are going to help me do it because I can't take corporeal form at all.
Yeah, again.
Is he dead?
I think he's dead.
How did he get into the state in the first place? Like, how was he able to do any of this? Again, what is in it for these kids?
So, I did a little reading on this character. Again, he never comes up again, because why would he? But in some of the Star Trek novel apocrypha stuff, there is apparently a line of novels where this character does appear again. And he is teamed up with... I think some entities from the Q continuum and also the god alien from Star Trek V.
Hmm.
And the gist seems to be that these omnipotent aliens are actually starting to work together because they knew each other like a millennia ago or whatever. But again, that's apocrypha. None of that is actually canon. And also, that sounds really stupid in a different way. So I don't really care that much.
I guess some kind of Legion of Doom or something. Ghosts.
The story for these aliens is really dumb, and the way they try to explain it is even dumber.
Yeah.
I mean, you get the moment of like exposition right from Spock later on, where he's just like, hey, I probably should have mentioned this, but like, there is this legend about.
It's just a legend, sir.
Spock, what do we know about the race that lived here?
According to the legend, Triacus was the seat of a band of marauders who made constant war throughout the system of Epsilon Indy. After many centuries, the destroyers were themselves destroyed by those they had preyed upon.
Is that the end of it?
No. Like so many legends, this one too has a frightening ending. It warns that the evil is awaiting a catalyst to set it again into motion and send it marauding across the galaxy.
Is it possible that the evil found the catalyst?
I was speaking of a legend, Captain.
But most legends have their basis in facts, Spock.
I think I read you, Jim. But as medical officer, I must warn you that unless the normal grief is tapped and released from these children, you are treading dangerously.
I understand your diagnosis, Doctor, and I will respect it. But not to the exclusion of the safety of the Enterprise. Thank you.
It's just a legend about, you know, things that are these marauders who are banished to this planet and want revenge. I mean, I didn't think it was important.
Yeah, apparently it's very important.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all just it's primarily a failure of writing and then performance after that. You know, like, there's nothing wrong with the scaffolding of this episode. Like,
yeah.
Like, creepy demonic children who had their parents killed and are taking over the ship is like a perfectly fine idea, like kernel of an idea for an episode, right? Like, they just don't do anything to justify it, and then the performances don't sell why it's scary or bad or even why it's happening.
Yeah, it's the content that fails, because everything they do to mind control or spook the crew is impossibly corny.
Yeah.
Impossibly corny.
I mean, and in better writing and maybe better acting also, but I'll say in better writing, you could be like, well, that's what a kid would think is like very high stakes, right? Like, ooh, a bunch of swords in space. Like, that's dangerous.
Yeah, but that shouldn't work on an adult is the thing. Like, the kids might think the swords are scary, but why does Sulu?
He's been thinking about this his whole career, that storm.
I know he fences, but come on, man.
This is it. This is his worst nightmare.
And, like, of course, Uhura can't stand the fact of looking at herself old and dying.
I see my death. A long death. Disease and pain.
I see my death.
Lieutenant, there's nothing there.
Oh, God! Captain, don't let it be.
I don't even know what they do to fucking Chekhov. Chekhov just gets dumb.
I think his idea of, like, not following an order, his fear of being...
Sure.
I have to follow an order?
I mean, that's kind of what they do to the engineering guys, too, though. Like, they're just like, we have orders from the bridge, we can't do anything. And then we never see Scott get turned. He just does.
He just is. I think maybe you're going to break the ship if you do it. You know, his sensitive instruments, right? Like, you're going to break my ship.
I want you to override the bridge navigation system, plot a course for Starbase 4.
I can't do that, sir. Why not? These are very sensitive instruments. I will not have you upset their delicate balance. We would all be lost, forever lost.
But what's also interesting is that Bones basically just disappears from the episode at this point. Like, he shows up every once in a while to be like, these kids aren't grieving properly. Bye. And that's it.
I feel like he would be like, God damn it, Jim. They're kids. Just take them outside.
Shove them out an airlock. Who cares? Hit them with a switch. Let's go.
Let's go.
Like, we back in Georgia. That's how we did it.
Yeah, he is just disappeared.
Yeah, and I mean, he kind of fares better than everyone else in this episode. What happens to Spock? Because Spock feels like he's resisting, but I can never tell how well it's working.
I mean, he gives in at some point, right? But then he stops giving in and turns back.
He, like, Vulcans his way through it, I think.
But they don't even show him doing that.
His hand wavers.
Yeah, like, he won't do a thing that Kirk tells him to, like, do at one point.
He refuses to contact Starfleet, right? Like, he basically is just like, why bother Starfleet? Everything's under control here.
But then as soon as they get off the bridge, they're just like, okay, they never talk about it. It's like, what were you doing to resist them? Could you resist them? It's just like, after that, he just isn't really being mind-controlled anymore.
My favorite of the mind controls, out of all the ones we've just mentioned, or bits here, is the guy who's working, the security guy by the door, who just is standing there while Kirk talks backwards.
Like, they're playing him a fucking Led Zeppelin record backwards.
Take Mr. Sulu to his quarters. He's relieved of duty.
But does it respond at all? Like, you're just gonna... He doesn't even make... He's just listening to his captain speak backwards. It's just
words.
Like,
I don't know.
Kirk's having another moment. Just stare at him. Just don't break eye contact. He does this sometimes.
Not being paid enough to speak, so I can't do anything here.
It's like nothing. He's not like, what? So the captain, I don't understand your order. He's just, he's gonna fucking rip me a new one. This is just his thing.
That's the only one I think is kind of fun, is the talking backwards bit. Like, it's not scary or weird, really, but I do think it is just like a fun little bit of confusion just using audio reversal technology. That's it.
I guess, but it's just like, that dude should be like, I just cannot understand what you're saying.
Yeah, please, Captain, can you do something for me here?
Yeah.
Then they beam those guys into space, and then our personal injury lawyer shows up on the bridge and just kind of yells at the kids for a minute, and then just
he yells the plot,
and then doesn't address any of the other people in the room at all.
There's a real like, hey, we can see you. We can all see you.
We're kind of hearing here. All this.
We're all here, dude.
No, just nothing. Just a whole bunch of nothing. And then they scare Kirk, and he's like, ah! Yeah.
I'm losing command.
Get me into the elevator, Ocon!
I'm losing command. I'm losing the Enterprise. Ship is sailing on and on. I'm alone.
Spock slaps him around and he's okay.
So I need to be clear, everything we have just talked about from them getting off to the planet to where we are right now is like 35 minutes of this episode.
Oh yeah, it just drags.
They drag every one of these bits out interminably. And the only time I kind of cheered is when they finally punch Chekhov in the face and just get rid of those guys, because I feel like, okay, finally, we're on the path to solving this. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yes.
Like,
yes.
Final confrontation doesn't even take place until like 5 minutes from credits or less.
And it's barely a confrontation.
Right. Like, I still am not entirely sure how they talk their way out of this.
Like, the way they talk their way out of it is just like the kids have kind of taken over the bridge. Kirk just kind of comes in and is like, you little shits. We recorded you doing your stupid song that summons this guy, so we're going to summon him.
Also, you don't have to do the dance in circle. It's just the damn song. You guys are idiots.
You morons.
Or like, hey, I'm going to subvert this guy's hold on these kids by reminding them that they are responsible for the deaths of their parents.
Totally. It is the thing Bones was like, hey, man, that's a little rough. Maybe we hold back on that. And Kirk's like, no.
Yeah.
They need to know.
Like the cuts in succession to each child after they have applied the fake tears to their face, though.
I have never... in all of my watching of movies.
And we've watched a lot of things for this podcast.
There are some things I've watched even outside this podcast, seen such poorly applied tears.
It's the kid with the bowl cut who is the child of the personal injury lawyer, actually. Mm-hmm. Like,
where they miss
kid. literally just has kind of a neutral expression on his face, but there is a single whatever fake tears are made of kind of rolling down from the corner of his eye.
Mm-hmm.
Just the most stagey thing.
It's like they just do tears in like different places on all the kids' eyes too. Some are in the corners, some are in the middle. And then the girl eventually just has a wash of tears, like she's from a fucking manga or anime.
The girl looks like she just had a particularly bad episode of Hot Ones. Like, that is where she is at compared to everyone else.
I mean, her whole face is just a river.
Like, she and the older kid are at least trying to act.
Yeah. I feel like the other one's not so much.
The other kids, who granted don't really have many or like kind of any lines in this episode.
Yeah.
Or just kind of chilling.
Look at the camera a little bit and blink.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, so here's the thing is that, like, I think the bit where Kirk shows them the videotapes of them frolicking with their parents on this planet and having a good old time, I think that would have been so much more effective if you had seen previously other footage of the parents being kind of terse or being kind of doing something that would annoy the children or make them unhappy in a way.
Remember the good times.
Like,
that
would make remembering the good times, I think, a lot more potent than it is here, where it really does feel like it is just the thing that turns on the waterworks. And then once the waterworks are on, somehow the entire hold this alien has on these children is just over.
You are my future generals. Together we can raise armies of followers. Go to your post. First great victories are upon us. You will see. We have millions of friends on Marcus 12. We shall exterminate all who oppose us. Our purity of purpose cannot be contaminated by those who disagree, who will not cooperate, who do not understand. They must be annihilated.
Don't be afraid. Look at them. Without you children, he's nothing. The evil remains within him.
I command you, to your post. Carry out your duties, or I will destroy you. You will be swept aside to make way for the strong.
Andy. He really is.
Look at him. And don't be afraid.
Death to you all. Death to you all. Death to you all.
Yeah, and then the facade breaks, and then this guy turns into a Pizza the Hut or whatever he turns into.
Dog,
I don't know if that's...
They literalize the fact that he is a huge piece of shit.
He just turns into Chet from Weird Science. And then is this what the alien's supposed to look like?
I can't tell.
I don't know. It seemed more like he's just kind of disintegrating to me.
Yeah. But
also, this actor repeating death to you all, like, or again, is not an actor.
Death to you all.
To be clear, but yeah, like, just, man.
Death to you all.
Tragic mistake. Casting.
Death to you all.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what he does in the courtroom.
I bet he's a fine lawyer. Yeah. As they go. I don't know. But it's just such a limp confrontation at the end. Vinny, you said it best. It is straight up a Scooby-Doo ghost.
It's Scooby-Doo, yeah. It just reminded me at the end of just, like, pulling the mask off.
Yeah, and it's just like, and then now the kids are like, shit, we're traumatized. What do we do now?
And then Bones, yeah, like you said earlier, Bones comes in, is, like, pretty stoked that they're all upset.
They're crying, Jim. I don't know how it happened, but it's good to see.
It's all right, Mary. It's all right. It's all right, isn't it, Doctor?
Yes, it's all right. We can help them now.
They can feel grief again. Yay!
I mean, I know why. I mean, like, they make it clear. He thinks they need to be grieving healthily, but still, just plays.
He's like, drop them off.
It just plays weird. The whole end of this episode plays weird because that's kind of the end of it.
Yep. Get those kids to the trauma center. Let's get back to our space business.
Now we can help these kids. All right. Well, where were we going?
I don't know. I don't think they know.
Credits.
Just like Kirk holding a kid, maybe being like, you know, last episode they stoned my wife to death.
It's not funny, but yeah.
No, just like, you know, hey, good luck with this. Don't worry, by next episode you'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, like I think I salute them trying to get away from the quip of the week ending.
Yes.
Kind of device that they have been using, but they have not really found it yet.
No, again, that was very much a Gene L. Kuhn thing, and now that he's gone, they are trying to find their new tone, and I just don't think they ever find it in this season.
Yeah, you weren't here for this, Brad, but we watched the... this feels like it should end with those five children silhouetted in a ghostly form, being like, the children, they're so... the Night of the Hunter, the children, uh-huh. They're so resilient. They're just,
it's so hard out here for the little ones in space.
For the little ones, yes, in space. It is... It is just such a weird vibe to this that just doesn't work, doesn't land.
Like, I can deal with any good single episode story arc as long as there's just feels like there is a point to it. Nothing is achieved in this episode. These children, we don't learn anything about grief. We don't learn anything about the nature of children. We don't even really learn anything about the nature of this stupid fucking alien that is like the central access point of this entire episode. It's just spinning wheels for almost the entire runtime.
I found the whole thing to be a little bit uncomfortable and off-putting, honestly, in how poorly it handles the subject matter it's trying to deal with. Like, it just...
It's just kind of grody.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I'm kind of just glad it's over.
Me too.
And, again, not to be forgotten, those two security team guys that just were like... blown out into space.
As bleak as that is, that's at least one of the more interesting things in this episode, honestly.
Yes. There isn't a lot. That is one of the only things that is memorable.
Like, all right. I know we're not really here to dissect the episode, but for
we are, actually. I mean, as best it can be.
Well, the science problem. One last thing. Do the kids, like, beat the influence? Is that what we think happened at the end? Like, have pushed it away, and now this space ghost is just gone from...
I don't know if it happened because they just got sad and that lost their... The dude lost his hold, or if they literally agencied their way into no longer believing in him, or if it's... I don't know.
Okay. It's like a Santa Claus thing. You just have to stop
it's
believing.
Like being can only subsist on the belief of its followers, and once they stop believing, it's just gone.
Like, quarantine this planet. Nobody goes back to this haunted planet.
Not even a one sentence explanation for any of that. It's just, nope, we're done here. Bye.
Yeah. A reverse course. Let's go home.
Well, look, here's what I'm going to say. Brad, I'm glad you're back.
Thank you.
I'm glad we can continue on with Star Trek. And I really do think that while there will be more bad episodes, I'm not sure they get much worse than these.
Okay. That's, again, that is somewhat encouraging.
At least from the stuff I remember. So now we do have two more episodes coming up next week, as always. And I remember one of these, and it's dumb, but I don't think it's super bad. So at least there's that. The one I haven't seen is the next one. Is there in truth no beauty is the name of the episode. Oh. And once again, frequent Star Trek guest collaborator Diana Muldaur stars in this one as well.
Okay, cool.
The one I have seen, which is just very silly from what I recall, we'll see if it actually holds up to that memory or not, is Spectre of the Gun, which I'm going to read you the description for this episode. As punishment for ignoring their warning and trespassing on their planet, the Melkot condemned Captain Kirk and his landing party to the losing side of a surreal recreation of the 1881 historic gunfight at the OK Corral.
Okay.
I mean, they had to make the Western stuff just textual at some point, right?
Yep. At least this time an alien's doing it, and they didn't just find people from 1881 on a planet, I guess. I don't know if that makes it better or not, but those are our episodes for next week, and I do think they will at least be a little better than these were.
That was Star Trek.
It's an uneven season, folks. We're here for the ride, though, and I'm happy to be taking it again with our good friend Bradley and everyone here on the show. For now, I think we're going to wrap these two up. They really don't deserve much more conversation than what we've given them. So, as always, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who's been listening and watching along at home with us. We'll see you next time. Hopefully, it'll be better.
I'm alone.
I'm so happy.
I'm alone.
I'm so happy.
I'm alone.
I'm so happy.
I'm alone.
I'm so happy.